Good morning, everybody. This is Music Sunday, but here I'm here to talk about cultural misappropriation. When I was a young man, I played in a band called Hot Borscht. As the name suggests, this was a band that played a lot of bar and bat mitzvahs and Jewish wedding receptions. And it was an unusual experience for me. I was raised a Protestant. I never really knew that much about Judaism until I went to college. I sort of felt that it was a foreign world, protected from outsiders, to which I had an occasional glimpse. What I do remember, though, is what I felt when I saw a Jewish wedding reception for the first time, with its ecstatic dancing and the bride and the groom being lifted up on chairs. I thought, wow, this is way more fun than any wedding I've ever seen before. But I assumed I would never actually take part in it. I wouldn't be welcome. It wouldn't be my thing. Well, many of you know my daughter, Amelia. She grew up in this church. She's now 30, almost. When she got to college, I assumed she'd be an English major, but it turned out she was a religion major. And she fell in love with Sam, who is an Orthodox Jew. So she became an Orthodox Jew herself. She and Sam got married last summer. Indeed, it was the weekend of August 11th through 12th when all the stuff was happening here about blacks and Jews. Everyone became aware of the precarious situation in our society. And at this wedding reception, suddenly I was in the circle. I was welcomed into the circle. I was in the midst of all that ecstatic dancing. Indeed, as the father of the bride, I was at its very center. But still, when I went back to her synagogue, actually last weekend, I went wearing a yarmulke, and I still felt like an imposter. I felt like I didn't quite belong. That same feeling of being both inside and outside of a culture reminded me of something that happened a few weeks before that wedding at the annual meeting of the UUMN. That is the Unitarian Universalist Musicians Network. It's an annual gathering that brings together all the music directors and other musical professionals for a conference. And every year we have a choral clinician, somebody who directs a choir made up entirely of music directors. And I have to say, that's a fabulous sound. And he gives workshops. He or she, I should say. And last year, our choral clinician was Brian Tate. He's somebody that we're actually going to be singing stuff later in the service. He's a composer who, among other things, is well known for writing gospel-style pieces suitable for and beloved by UU congregations. Among the UUs present there was a man named Duro Farrar. He is the music director at the Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon. He's a brilliant musician, and he also happens to be an African American. He later wrote in a fairly lengthy email, which I will quote from, "I will not tell you all how to feel, but I will tell you of my own experience. Sitting in the sanctuary of the UUMN conference this summer and listening to Brian Tate explicitly claim to have copied the musical styles of black Americans hurt me deeply. Here's why. What the hell does Brian Tate know about black American music, he being a white Canadian? And I'm not talking about what history and anthropological information any of us can learn from enough reading. I'm talking about the heart space. Living as a black American is hard, painful. It's hard, painful work on a daily basis. That struggle and pain shows up in our music. To have that mimicked or mocked by anyone, either for profit or simply because it makes our audiences happy, I'm reminded of plantation minstrels, offends me. I do not believe white people should not be able to sing and perform black music. I do not believe white composers should strip black music from their well of influence, and the UU leadership has never held that position. But I do believe that white religious liberals need to start listening to the people of color within and around them and stop discounting us because you perceive that we are angry, dramatic, or opportunistic. Each of us needs to look within ourselves and within our music programs to rethink how we might be able to, how we might be feeding the perpetuation of white supremacy in the broader society. End quote. Well, this is an impassioned statement on a touchy subject. Whether or on what terms predominantly white you use, and I'd guess the UUMN is about 90-95% white, whether they can use the music of black Americans. So let's take a look at this statement a little more closely. First of all, he's not claiming black music as an exclusive resource. Anyone can perform it. Anyone creating music can use it as a source or influence. But he is letting us know how he felt about it. And he's not asking that we share his emotions. He's asking that we listen to him, a fellow UU, as he explains why he feels this way. And his feeling is this: black religious music, whether it's gospels, spirituals, or whatever, emerges from the experience of black Americans. That experience is not one that we all share. It is an experience that anyone who knows what it feels like to have a black skin in this society does share. Moreover, that music takes on meaning from this experience. It's a hard, painful experience, one that runs contrary to the kind of American dream that we feel we all share. We have to respect that. We have to treat that carefully. There's another aspect to his statement, a parenthetical comment that deserves attention, when he said, "I'm reminded of plantation minstrels." Minstrelsy was, of course, a stage entertainment starting in the 1840s in which white people wearing blackface purported to represent the plantation slave, quote, as he really was. And this was the most popular entertainment in the United States in the whole 19th century. Actually, my wife pointed out that Laura Ingalls Wilder, you're familiar with those books? When she's in DeSmet, South Dakota, which is a tiny, tiny town, they had a minstrel show there in the books, just to kind of get a sense of the pervasiveness of this entertainment. It may be hard to imagine religious music in this context, but keep in mind how most white Americans first encountered black spirituals. In 1867, one of the earliest black colleges, Fisk University, opened its doors. Of course, it had very little money. And one of the ways they raised it was by forming a choral group, the Fisk Jubilee Singers, among their students. The Fisk Jubilee Singers' repertory consisted largely of black spirituals, which they knew very well and which most other people had never heard. They became internationally famous. They even sang for Queen Victoria. The spirituals became the core of black identity. W.E.B. Du Bois, in his 1902 Souls of Black Folk, began each chapter with a quotation from a different spiritual. They were published in choral arrangements by black arrangers like Nathaniel Dett and Harry Burley, and they were meant for any choir to perform. And this meant that it's been a staple of white choirs' repertory ever since. How many of you have sung a spiritual in a high school, college, or church choir? Yeah, I thought so. It's fairly pervasive. But at the same time, the spirituals entered the minstrel show. By this time, after the war, minstrels were not only white men in blackface, but increasingly black men in blackface, because their faces weren't dark enough. Spirituals were a regular part of the entertainment. Do you know the song, "Oh, Dem Golden Slippers, Oh, Dem Golden Slippers"? That was written by James Bland. He is a black composer educated at Howard University. He's probably best known for also writing Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. Just as Uncle Tom's Cabin moved from being a revolutionary abolitionist tract during the Civil War to a minstrel spectacle, complete with Eliza crossing the frozen Ohio River, Eva rising up to heaven, and Topsy's ecstatic dancing, the spirituals, too, lost their dignity. It was another way of showing the religiosity of those simple people. And it wasn't just a 19th century thing. Minstrelsy began to exit the American stage at the beginning of the 20th century, but it cast a very, very long shadow. Have you ever heard of the movie The Green Pastures? Probably not, but in 1938, it was a big Warner Brothers production, full of happy black people in angels' wings, singing spirituals to praise the Lord. The book's author once described The Green Pastures as the story of heaven and of earth as it might be imagined by a very simple, devout people. Whether it's the Lord's office up in the clouds, or the big fish fry in heaven, or the nightclub in Babylon. This is black religiosity as a spectacle. Reducing music from black churches, which of course was the mainstay of most African American communities, to a form of entertainment. And in presenting spirituals as a simple, happy expression, ignoring both the hard, painful parts of the black experience and the intelligence of the black people who created that culture, this entertainment is a lie. Some of that has rubbed off on the spectacle of white people singing spirituals. We do so unthinkingly. We participate in that lie. You remember, of course, that when Thomas Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal," he owned slaves. And everybody knows Martin Luther King's famous 1963 speech from the Washington Mall, or at least that magnificent coda that begins, "I have a dream." But fewer remember that the opening salvo was an economic metaphor, that the words of Jefferson and other founders were a promissory note. And let me quote Martin Luther King. "In a sense, we have come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt, so we have come to cash this check, a check that will give us, upon demand, the riches of freedom and the security of justice." Well, in much the same way, this is not Martin Luther King anymore, sorry, much the same way, black religious music, which comes from the heart and soul of African Americans and represents their noblest impulses, this music is demanding our respect. I was reading this week's New York Review of Books. There was an article by Daryl Pinkney called "The Afro-Pessimist Temptation," about Ta-Nehisi Coates' latest book. He describes much of Coates' book, his argument, as Afro-pessimism, the idea that, quote, integration has failed us, that the civil rights movement was, quote, exiting the American stage in a cloud of gloom, with black Americans troubled by the persistence of racism and the seeming indifference of much of the country to black Americans' fate. Coates writes, "The essence of American racism is disrespect." Some of that anger and hurt is clearly evident in Durow-Farrar's remarks. But at the same time, Pinkney bluntly states, Afro-pessimism is not found in the black church. Afro-pessimism is not found in the black church. So it's not like saying that white UUs can't sing gospel. They can, under some circumstances. The first meeting of the UUMN I attended was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It may surprise you to learn that the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Tulsa is perhaps the largest congregation in our denomination. It's also probably the most diverse, with a sizable African American presence. That's due to Carlton Pearson. Carlton Pearson was a powerful evangelical preacher in Tulsa until he had a vision that corresponds closely to universalism. In other words, the idea that everybody is already saved. This caused him to be expelled by his church, even branded a heretic. And frankly, if you want to see a Hollywood version of this, it has just come out on Netflix. It's called Come Sunday with Chiwetel Ejiofor, the star of 12 Years a Slave as Pearson, so check it out. But Pearson brought a sizable core of his followers to All Souls UU Church, transforming the church. I saw their services. They have an excellent gospel band and a small gospel choir led by David B. Smith. This group can really play gospel music. But the repertory isn't really Christian. It's UU hymns, our own familiar melodies and words. To me, it was an ecstatic experience. I love gospel music, but my experience of it has always been schizophrenic. Part of me is passionately involved, and then there's another part. That annoying voice in my head kept saying, "Don't get carried away. You know you don't believe this." So that's going on while I'm listening to it. In the All Souls Church, for the first time in my life, that voice was stilled. I immersed myself in a musical religious experience that satisfied my heart and soul and was truly Unitarian Universalist. Black culture and Jewish culture may seem very far apart, but my experience of both, my experience dancing in my daughter's wedding and this experience of singing gospels in the UU Church in Tulsa, they feel related. For both Jews and black people, religion and history are deeply intermixed, and these histories are both hard and painful. Not surprisingly, each culture tends to exclude those people who have not shared it. It's intense and it's personal. I quoted from the Seder, the words that Cyprus read earlier, to convey this. According to one source, the Seder requires every participant to feel as though he or she had personally just left Egypt. To understand that religion means understanding its history. And we've got to end our carelessness about history. We've got to pay attention. We've got to realize that these cultures, black or Jewish, they have something to teach us. I chose that reading from the Seder because black people in slavery heard the story of Moses in Egypt and recognized that what they heard in the Old Testament was relevant to them, which is why they created that hymn. They took it seriously. Borrowing across cultures is possible. To do it, we have to hear and understand the history within them. May we keep our ears open and join together to make that possible. Thank you.